next president needs to condition the American public and the rest of the world to both the Arab American, American Jewish communities, and talk about the Middle East to construct what I call an American narrative. You do those things, and we'll at least be moving in the right direction.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. We are pleased today to be partnering with the International Relations Organization, whose Vice President Peter Isikoff is here with us, a great student organization at the University of Virginia. And we've also worked closely with Professor William Quant, who is an old, well, he's not that old, but he's a friend of many years standing with our distinguished speaker. We are pleased to welcome today to the Miller Center, Aaron David Miller, who currently is a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Dr. Miller served at the State Department as an advisor to six secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations between 1978 and 2003. Dr. Miller received his PhD in American Diplomatic and Middle East History from the University of Michigan, and then joined the State Department a year after he completed his doctoral work. During his career at the State Department, where he served as Deputy Special Middle East Coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations, among other senior positions, Dr. Miller was awarded the Department's Distinguished, Superior, and Meritorious Honor Awards. He's published widely in the academic as well as the popular press, and his most recent book, which he will be signing after the end of the forum, is The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for an Arab-Israeli Peace. Please welcome Aaron David Miller.
Thanks. Welcome to all of you. It's a pleasure and an honor for me to be at the Miller Center. I want to thank George Gilliam for hosting me, Bill Quant, who I've known for years, for convincing me to address what I thought was a fascinating two-hour session of his class, and Peter Isikoff for allowing me an opportunity to speak before the IRO later this evening. A few personal comments before I begin. I don't want to give a lecture. I want to share a number of observations with you and then leave some time for questions and comments. But in the interest of full disclosure, a couple things need to be said. Number one, I'm not running for anything. I'm associated with no one's campaign. I don't want to be associated with anyone's campaign. I had my 25 years in government. They were among the most productive, meaningful, and extraordinary years of my life. I think it's extremely important, however, and my, part of my new trope is that there probably ought to be term limits imposed on former advisors to secretaries of state and presidents, particularly when their policies don't lead to effective results. Because in the end, ultimately, we can rationalize and justify all we want. One of the world's most compelling ideologies, perhaps the most compelling ideology, is not nationalism, not capitalism, not democracy, but success. Because success generates real power, and success generates constituents. And failure, on the other hand, generates the opposite. As a consequence of my newfound detachment, which I've come to value, I can be clear and honest in a way that was difficult while I was in government. Difficult not because I pulled my punches or somehow was afraid to be clear and honest, but because I was caught up in an enterprise that is historic and quite remarkable, and I think lost track along the way of certain realities. Life in the end is a balance, really, whether it's in your personal life or your professional life. And the balance is trying to find the center between the way the world is on one hand and the way you want it to be on the other. Diplomacy is, successful diplomacy is very much along the same lines. And I suspect for America that balance in many respects have been lost, and it has created, sadly for us, too many illusions along the way. And I am determined in my new role not to tolerate or accept illusions. And it's with this in mind that I want to offer a number of observations along the way. I said that success is the world's most compelling ideology, and I mean it. For the last 16 years, eight under a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, we stumbled with respect to how to assist Arabs and Israelis in making peace. And for an additional 8 years under George W. Bush, we stumbled galactically about how to make war. War, preventative war, preemptive war, war of choice, regardless. Great powers, particularly when they go to war, the war becomes literally the auditor of a nation's institutions. And I'm not sure we passed the audit. And we are failing both at peacemaking and war making in a part of the world that is incredibly important to our national security. The primary threat to our national interests and those of our friends abroad will not come from an ascendant China or a former Soviet Union seeking to regain its previous glories or for an economically united and powerful Europe. These are all legitimate foreign policy challenges. Primary threat to America will come from an angry, dysfunctional, rage-ridden, and conflict-ridden Middle East. 9/11, for many people, was, it's history. It's a tragic, historical event. But it was the second day, bloodiest day in American history, exceeded only by September 17th, 1862. During the Battle of Antietam, in which more Americans were killed in a single day than in any other day of American history. The primary purpose of a nation's foreign policy is to protect your homeland. If you can't protect your homeland, you don't need a foreign policy. And I would argue that 16 years of near misses and very few successes and failures have left America more vulnerable than ever before. So what I would like to do is to offer up, and I will pepper these sets of observations perhaps with stories from the book or maybe during the Q&A, 10 ideas that I would like the next president of the United States to consider with respect to the issue I know best. It has resonance for the broader region. This one is extremely important. And that new president is going to confront a Middle East that is terribly turbulent and difficult. We are, in a way, in an investment trap. We cannot fix this region. No great power has ever managed to do that. The last 1,500 years is littered with the remains of great powers who believe they could impose their will, wrongly, I might add, on small tribes. But we cannot extricate ourselves from it. That's the dilemma that the new president will face. And there are no easy or quick successes here. That's the other problem. The region is integrated. Success or failure in one area invariably affects success or failure in the other. And I think we have to agree that governing really is about choosing. The next president is going to have to set priorities for himself. And I am not terribly optimistic, frankly, given the galactic nature of the challenges we face abroad and the extraordinarily shaky nature of our own internal house, that this is going to be an easy proposition. But I will offer these 10 observations. They are drawn essentially from traveling the negotiator's highway, and they're mine. We can argue about them all day long. I'm not in the Department of State anymore. I don't have to sell you even products that I believe in. Each of these propositions are arguable and contestable. And what I think is absolutely critical is that we contest them. Because the truth is, whether or not history repeats itself or whether or not there are lessons to be learned, we have to examine the sources of American success and of course American failure, if we're to learn. So let me offer them up. Number one, no bricks without straw. This has been a difficult proposition for me to accept. If Arabs and Israelis aren't ready and willing and able to make the extraordinary difficult decisions regarding peace and war, we, no matter how much we care about it, want it, and no matter how powerful we may think we are, will be able to make those decisions for them. Small powers who operate in an arena defined by an existential struggle, physical survival, political identity, will always, always have a greater stake in the outcome of their enterprise than a distant power thousands of miles away. And I would submit to you, perhaps I'm wrong, there is no historical precedent for a great power resolving without those who live in the neighborhood cooperating to the fullest extent possible of any conflict driven by memory, historical trauma, ethnic and sectarian identification, let alone by religion. This proposition is absolutely critical, and we have to internalize it and accept it. It doesn't mean that we have to be reactive. It doesn't mean that we need to sit idly by. There are things that can be done. Talking straight to our friends, talking to our adversaries and our enemies may be one very important, simple way to begin to prepare the ground. But if Arabs and Israelis are interested, then we need to test the proposition in a much more serious way than we ever tested it in 8 years of Bill Clinton's term, and certainly in 8 years of George W. Bush's. A process is fine. A process is simply another way of describing a problem that you cannot resolve today. A process is critical, but it will not be sufficient. And I'm not entirely persuaded that America should sit and participate in a process for its own sake, one that is dishonest, doomed to fail, and ultimately will undermine our own credibility. Second, nobody ever washes a rental car. Larry Summers, who worked with us, former Secretary of the Treasury, former President of Harvard, he's not the President of Harvard anymore because he said several controversial things, but one thing Larry said that was absolutely right, and every time I see him, I remind him of it. He said, in the history of the world, nobody ever washes a rental car. And when I quote Larry Summers, people wonder, what is this man talking about? What does this have to do with anything? It's a function of the human condition. You only care about what you own. Invariably, someone in my audiences from one end of America to the other will stand up and raise their hand and say, well, I washed a rental car. But it is not a normal human reaction. We need to care about Arab-Israeli peacemaking if we have any chance of succeeding. Because if we don't care, if we don't make it unmistakably clear to the Arabs and the Israelis and their respective partisans here, we will fail. We will certainly fail. We will be played like a finely tuned violin. We really will. So owning this means ensuring, if I'm right, that governing is about choosing, that the next president decides that this is a priority and begins to commit himself to educating, conditioning the American public, and constructing an American narrative, primarily an American narrative, which asserts America's primary national interests and explains why and how the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace fits into it. Explains it's not a panacea. Explains, however, that it is an issue that resonates broadly and deeply, and that a serious process that demonstrates this conflict is on the way to resolution will actually strengthen our friends, marginalize our enemies, and restore what we genuinely have lost. And I don't stand here as someone who is overly critical of America. These problems in this region are not primarily our fault. They grew out of so many structural factors and the dysfunction of a region still in the throes of political change. But frankly, I can also say honestly that we have not contributed positively to them or effectively, and in many cases, we have made them worse. I quote Michael Jackson in my book. I borrow liberally from a song he sings. I don't know who wrote the lyrics, called Man in the Mirror, and he simply says, if you want to make a change in your life, the place to start is by looking in the mirror. We don't do that well because we believe our motives are so well-intentioned that if we fail, it's largely a consequence either of somebody else's fault or responsibility, or we just didn't do it as well as we might have or could have or should have or would have. We need to accept responsibility for what we do right and what we don't do right. That means the next president appointing and empowering a Secretary of State who will be truly consequential. And there are three ingredients. And this appointment is critical to the seriousness of a president's commitment in this region because the president cannot be the desk officer that micromanages the Arab-Israeli peace process. Bill Clinton cared about this issue more than any other president, with the possible exception of Jimmy Carter. Bill Clinton, in my judgment, got too close to it. He took every phone call from Ehud Barak, every phone call from Hafez Assad. We became part of the furniture, no longer respected. And frankly, there's no one in this room, I'll put myself at the top of the list, no one in Washington, no one I've talked to since this split between Hamas and Fatah has developed, that has an answer to this problem. I do not have one. But fix it, or you will not have an agreement. And finally, the Israelis. The Israelis, 31 governments since 1948. The Israelis are going through a historic transition from a founding generation whose leaders had moral authority, historic legitimacy, and competency, to a set of younger, and I would argue now tested, in three different Israeli prime ministers, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, and Ehud Olmert. None of them have demonstrated the kind of competency and moral authority necessary to lead the people of Israel toward the kinds of existential choices that it will face. So it's not whether or not Ms. Livni can put together a government, or whether or not Ms. Livni or Benjamin Netanyahu becomes prime minister. And leaders can grow and they can develop and they can emerge, for sure. But this issue of leadership is absolutely critical. Without it, there won't be any kind of deal. Five. If you are for America, for an American Secretary of State, and for a president with respect to this issue, tough, smart, and fair. If you're not prepared to be tough, smart, and fair, find another conflict to mediate. But don't go into this one thinking or believing you're going to succeed, because you won't. You will fail. You will fail. Three, the next president needs to be Israel's best friend, but not its lawyer. And I want to be very clear about something here. I wrote an article in the Washington Post in May of 2005, which got me into an enormous amount of trouble. It was called Israel's Lawyer. It made a very simple point. Too many American officials, including myself, during the Clinton administration, in an effort to negotiate, far too frequently took the role of Israel's lawyer, Israel's attorney, instead of understanding that our client is the agreement. That is your primary client, and you become advocates and lawyers for both sides. The argument has such stunning simplicity to me. I don't care whether it's a good marriage, a good friendship, a good business proposition, good diplomacy. It must reflect the balance of interest between the two sides. Otherwise, it's not going to endure. If it endures, frankly, it's not going to be worth much. We are Israel's best friend. We have a special relationship with the Israelis, driven by value affinity, history, and by one other functional and very important idea, that we are, and it's a paradox, we are a partial mediator, which is why our phone rings. Our phone rings because we are perceived to have influence with the Israelis. But when we allow our special relationship to become exclusive, which is what has happened, in my judgment, in the last 16 years. We cannot possibly succeed. My friends in the Jewish community, do not appreciate this. They somehow believe that America is just waiting to sacrifice Israeli interests on the altar of American expediency. But there's no historical precedent for this. This is a myth. The debate between Israel's supporters and detractors in America, in my view, on the issue of whether or not there should be a special relationship with the state of Israel is over. The debate's over, it's ended. And the pro-Israeli community has won for many reasons. Bill Clinton was the most pro-Israeli Democratic president ever. George W. Bush was the most pro-Israeli Republican president ever. It doesn't matter who becomes president. When morning dawns again in America on January 20th, 2009, whether it's Barack Obama or John McCain, both will recommit themselves and deliver on that commitment to the special relationship. The question is, which of them, or will any of them, understand the distinction in diplomacy between being Israel's best friend, which we can be, but not being Israel's lawyer, which we cannot be, if we hope to succeed. I don't know, frankly, whether or not this realization is possible. I don't know. But I know that allowing the Israelis to shape our tactics and strategy when it comes to the Arab-Israeli peace process, demanding no reciprocity from the Israelis with respect to their own behavior and their own actions, not having a serious discussion with the Israelis when it comes to settlement activity, totally unrelated to their security, which has nothing to do with our commitment to safeguarding and maintaining Israel's qualitative edge or its security. And I would defy anyone to demonstrate when America has put Israel in harm's way. It's a myth. We have convinced ourselves, at least for the last 16 years, that we can't be Israel's best friend and be an effective mediator for this conflict. We need to unconvince ourselves. Four, the chances of a Palestinian-Israeli conflict-ending agreement, I choose my words very carefully here, a conflict-ending agreement in which the four core issues that drive the conflict, Jerusalem borders, refugees, and security, are resolved, where an Israeli leader stands up and a Palestinian leader stands up and says to their respective publics, the conflict is over. No more irredenta, all claims are adjudicated. The prospects of that happening in the near term are slim to none. This is not a realization that I'm happy about. It is not something that I loudly proclaim with any joy or glee. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the centerpiece of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Arab-Israeli conflict will not be over until it is resolved. I just do not see, based on reality, not the way I want the world to be, that you can have such a conflict-ending agreement anytime soon, for three reasons. The issues are incredibly difficult, and however much progress they've made, they're still very far apart on core identity issues like Jerusalem or refugees. Number two, let me put this carefully because it's extremely important. Unless there is internal order in the Palestinian house, one gun, one authority, one negotiating position, the idea that there can be a conflict-ending agreement between two states living side by side in peace and security is an illusion. I don't care if it's the city of Charlottesville or Chevy Chase where I live or Sweden or Egypt. The mark of the credibility of any polity is its capacity to maintain a monopoly over the forces of violence within its own society. It may do so as a democracy, it may do so as a dictatorship, as an authoritarian power, but it must maintain control over the forces of violence. That does not mean controlling all the guns. Obviously, there are too many guns in America. I don't want to get into this whole debate. There are many guns in America. That's not the issue. The issue is a political group cannot challenge the authority of the state through violence or attack the state's neighbors or pose a different political philosophy which erodes the very credibility of the state of which it is a part. You can't have an agreement and also have that. And frankly, there's no one in this room, I'll put myself at the top of the list, no one in Washington, no one I've talked to in the last, since this split between Hamas and Fatah has developed, that has an answer to this problem. I do not have one. But fix it, or you will not have an agreement. And finally, the Israelis. The Israelis, 31 governments since 1948. The Israelis are going through a historic transition from a founding generation whose leaders had moral authority, historic legitimacy, and competency, to a set of younger, and I would argue now tested, in three different Israeli prime ministers, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, and Ehud Olmert. None of them have demonstrated the kind of competency and moral authority necessary to lead the people of Israel toward the kinds of existential choices that it will face. So it's not whether or not Ms. Livni can put together a government, or whether or not Ms. Livni or Benjamin Netanyahu becomes prime minister. And leaders can grow and they can develop and they can emerge, for sure. But this issue of leadership is absolutely critical. Without it, there won't be any kind of deal. Five. If you know Obama and you're getting advice and one of your advisors says, these are the realities on the Israeli-Palestinian track. It's central to the conflict, but these are the realities. And another advisor says, look, boss, there's this thing called an Israeli-Syrian agreement out there. Clinton came very close, which is true. It involves two states. There are a limited number of Israeli settlers on the Golan Heights. There's no Jerusalem issue. Religion isn't a major factor. And you have one agreement negotiated by Henry Kissinger, signed on June 1st, 1974, which has made the Israeli-Syrian border the quietest space in the region. This is the agreement, Mr. President, if you want to stand a chance of succeeding. And by the way, there's an added bonus to it. Because if you get it, you'll begin to confront other non-state actors, Hezbollah, Hamas, and even the Iranians, with a set of choices. Don't ask for too much here, but you could start into motion a reconfiguration of American influence, which could serve our interests. That is going to be the choice, it seems to me, for the next administration. An Israeli-Syrian agreement, excruciatingly painful. It will cost a lot of money. It's going to involve an enormous amount of time and arm twisting and reassurance in order to make it work. But it can be done, and it would allow America to succeed. We haven't negotiated or brokered a successful Arab-Israeli agreement since Jim Baker took the Arabs and Israelis to the Madrid Peace Conference in October of 1991, and that wasn't an agreement. It was a consequential event. Not since then have we succeeded in brokering one agreement that has endured. That doesn't make us look good. It makes us look bad. And we can't afford to look bad, particularly now. Six, dealing with the fox in the chicken coop. Now, this is a rather pejorative way of describing a subject that Ruhi Ramazani knows. He's going to forget more about Iran than I'm ever going to know. But some way has to be found to deal with the question of Iran, because everything we've tried has failed. And the last thing we need is a military confrontation whose consequences and implications would be, I suspect, fundamentally even more severe than the trillion-dollar social science project that we have launched called Iraq. And I say this because this has cost us. The question is, I hope Iraq emerges as a democratic polity. I really do. But that's really not the question. The question is, what does it cost? What does it cost America? And what were we thinking? I asked my audiences if they could answer this question. How many Americans were killed during the entire American occupation of Japan from 1945 to 1952?
Zero.
Right, zero. Now, I'm not trying to draw analogies. I'm just trying to pose the question. When you initiate a preemptive, preventative war, essentially a war of choice, without a compelling national interest in committing American forces to battle, you better know what you're doing. You better know how to execute it. You better know how to run an occupation. You better know what to do with a failed state when you strip its authoritarian cover off and hope somehow that Shia, Sunnis, and Kurds will think more about the future than they will getting even for what they have done to one another in the past. And we didn't think about this. We didn't think about it. So before we go off on another adventure, we need to think it through. I don't have an answer for this problem. This is the second issue that the great geniuses that comment and talk about American foreign policy don't have an answer for either. I don't know what would work with the Iranians. I don't know if there's a big deal, a grand bargain, no deal. I don't know what the Iranians really want. I don't know if our interests are mutually compatible. But we have to find a way to test in a serious way and figure it out. Because Iran is a consequential power. They sit at the nexus of everything we care about. Nuclear proliferation, the Arab-Israeli issue, Iraq, Lebanon. And that's really, really important. Seven, we're going to have to be a broker if we want to succeed, not a facilitator. And I'm not talking about pushing America in if the Arabs and the Israelis don't want us in. But if they ask us in, we need to quickly and rapidly make an assessment of what is required to make a deal. If the gaps are bridgeable, then we should discuss with each party, each side, what the bridging proposals are and get a negotiation going where the gaps can be bridged. If they're not, then we'll draw additional conclusions. But we are going to need to be there. I wish it weren't so. I wish it weren't so that every success in this region has essentially been partly orchestrated by American diplomacy. Henry Kissinger's disengagement agreements of the 70s, Jimmy Carter's 1979 peace treaty, and the first President Bush and Jim Baker's efforts to, in the wake of the first Persian Gulf War, to produce the Madrid Peace Conference. Those are our three consequential successes in Arab-Israeli diplomacy. An American role was critical in a primary way in each of them. We can't, there'll be no Arab-Israeli peace on the cheap. It'll have to involve an American role. Eight, even if you can manage to negotiate a comprehensive solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's no panacea. This is a tough region for many different reasons. We are, I believe, in an investment trap. We can act wisely, we can act foolishly. We're going to be there not for administrations. I measured my life for over 20 years in terms of 4 and 8 year increments. That's not the right way to approach this region. It's a generational proposition. We need to look at it as a generational proposition because after all, time is the ultimate arbiter of anything of value anyway. And we need a serious strategy that lasts beyond administrations. I'm a baseball fan, unfortunately. I have the Baltimore Orioles and the Washington Nationals to root for. But our image in this part of the world is important. Casey Stengel once said that the key to good management, even though I don't like the Yankees, is keeping the nine guys who hate your guts away from the nine guys who haven't made up their minds. There are a lot of people in the Middle East who have yet to make up their minds about America. Some may hate us because we love freedom. There may be a clash of civilizations at work, but I don't think that's the way the majority look at us. It's a clash of interests. They see the world a different way. They see their problems a different way than we do. The question is whether or not through diplomacy and effective public diplomacy and American engagement, some of these problems can't be ameliorated by looking at their interests and ours and trying to figure out a way to reach a reasonable modus vivendi. Nine, we need to see the world the way it is, not the way we want it to be. And as Americans, it's very hard for us. It really is. If you want to understand, I think, why America behaves abroad the way it does, I think the point of departure is location, location, and location. We are the only great power in the history of the world to have achieved the kind of unprecedented, unrivaled, unparalleled physical security. No other great power has ever come close. We have non-predatory neighbors to our north and to our south. And to quote the French ambassador from the 1920s, we have fish to our east and west. If you, and I mean this seriously, if you want to begin to understand why America conducts itself abroad the way we do, this is the place to start. It explains our pragmatism, the notion that problems can have solutions. It explains our optimism, the notion that we can bring solutions. It explains our naivete, the fact that we've lost really a sense of what it's like to live on the knife's edge. We don't know that. And we think we understand it intellectually, but I don't think we do. And finally, it explains our arrogance when we talk more than we listen. We are an exceptional country. We really are an exceptional country. No other, and I'm not revealing a political bias here, but it's important that I make this point. There is no other democracy in the world, not the British, not the French, not the Australians, not the Canadians, not the Dutch, not the Israelis, who would ever elect or even consider electing a member of a minority who used to be enslaved, still despised by millions of Americans, and make that person the most powerful man in the world. Only America could conceive of that. Bonaparte was a Corsican. He seized power by force. Stalin was a Georgian. Yes, these are minorities, but it's not the same. We just have to understand that our exceptionalism works for us. It may not work for everybody. George Kennan once said that unless there is an overriding purpose in minding the business of others, there's overriding virtue in minding your own business. Finally, I will close on a note of optimism, because by and large, that's the way I really do see the world. The first and last president who ever had an impact on me was Jack Kennedy. I was 12 when he was assassinated. Kennedy said something about himself which is phenomenal. And if you don't take anything else away from here today, take this away. He described himself as an idealist without illusion. An idealist without illusion. Never give up on the possibility that the world can be changed. But as you go through the process of trying to change it, do so with your eyes wide open. Thank you.
You mentioned that the failures that the United States has been involved in the Middle East have outnumbered the successes. If you were the new president coming in, what would you do in the first year to make the United States relevant in the Middle East and to take the first steps towards achieving the vision that you have for the Middle East?
It's not a thought experiment. It's actually quite real. The next president has a campaign commitment which needs to be discharged, and that is extricating American forces from Iraq in a way, whether it's 2010, 2011, 2012. The process of extrication is absolutely critical, and whoever wins, it will be done under the rubric of three words: leaving without losing. Whether that is possible, losing, that's an interesting, I don't know. People have various standards by which to judge what it means to have won or lost in Iraq. But the process of extrication is a campaign commitment. It is the most serious, the economy is for sure, but in terms of the foreign policy issues, this is it. That's number one. And that process has to be authoritative, competent, and credible, and it has to demonstrate that, in fact, we are, because $10 billion a month is no longer a price that can be paid, not after what we've seen over the course of the last 3 months, 3 weeks. Second is another form of time constraint. It's a ticking clock. And that has to do with the issue of Iran. I am least gloomy here, frankly, than I am on the Arab-Israeli issue. I do not believe that next year there must be a confrontation between American Iran or Israel Iran over the nuclear issue. I don't want to take it for granted. There's much misperception here, much confusion. That would be the second priority. Start a meaningful process of serious and sustained high-level talks. Now, the talks may prove to be what I call a key to an empty room, maybe. But let's find out. That alone will enable us to create a moral authority, which I think is extremely important. And the next president needs to condition the American public and the rest of the world through his own statements and speeches to Congress, to both the Arab-American, American-Jewish communities, and talk about the Middle East, to construct what I call an American narrative, which explains why and how we need to approach this region. If you could add to that a more sensible policy of diplomacy to test the propositions, maybe I'm wrong, maybe the Israeli-Palestinian thing will come around, but to test the proposition in a reasonably compact and credible way, you do those things, and we'll at least have, we'll at least be moving in the right direction.
You've demonstrated how difficult it is for us to work out a solution, or at least to help and promote peace. And so in looking at this history, we seek some examples, some models of success. And you mentioned Secretary Baker, perhaps, was the exemplary case. So could you say a little more about what he did or how he did it that helps us to understand? And secondly, could we also look for a model in terms of what Jimmy Carter did with Sadat and Begin? And at least that seems to be an extraordinary development in that those countries had gone to war so many times with each other, and yet somehow they worked out an agreement that still has held up pretty well.
That actually, the Carter brokered Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, as Bill Quant knows, is the most consequential act of diplomacy that we have ever done in this region. There are two peace treaties now, one between Israel and Egypt, which we brokered, one between Israel and Jordan, which we supported, we didn't broker. The book creates a Peace Process Hall of Fame. I'm a baseball fan, and I nominated three Americans. I voted them in, and they're in permanently. You can't take them out. You can't be voted out. And nobody else gets in, not yet anyway. And there's no way to challenge them either. And no one in 4 months of selling this book has even remotely suggested that they don't belong there. Henry Kissinger for his work in the disengagement agreements, Jimmy Carter for the peace treaty, and Baker for what was essentially a procedural breakthrough, a peace conference at Madrid. It wasn't an agreement. But all three combined, as I say in the book, what I call the four or five T's, it's a nice alliteration, of effective diplomacy. All three shared these in common. So my answer, the question should be answered, there were opportunities, okay? October War for Henry Kissinger, Anwar Sadat for Jimmy Carter, Persian Gulf War for James Baker, which shook things up. But shaking things up is not good enough unless you have an effective, what Kissinger described as an effective hand to pull all the threads together. These three had, they were tough, they were tenacious. Kissinger's 34-day shuttle to do the Golan disengagement agreement is the longest time a Secretary of State has been outside of the United States continuously since Robert Lansing accompanied Woodrow Wilson to Versailles. They gained the trust of the parties. Now, they don't trust each other like my kids trust me and I trust them, but they found a way to work together. And timing. Each of the three understood how not to over-engage or under-engage. Bill Clinton tried to do too much. George Bush didn't do enough. And there's a fifth T, which I call togetherness. The President and the Secretary of State on this issue, even though the Kissinger-Nixon relationship was very complicated, were like this. Those five T's, you give me an Arab and Israeli, the raw material, and a Secretary of State and a President who's prepared to exhibit these five T's, chances are you'll get an agreement. That's what we need.
Thank you for your conference. And what about multilateralism and the involvement of the United States allies in this process? Is that not a great challenge for the next president?
It is, but we can actually use that to our advantage. One thing this administration did, even though it was not terribly serious, it created something called a quartet, which is a group composed of the EU, Russia, the UN, and America. The quartet could be used as a very effective mechanism for many things. But in this case, form follows function. There can only be one mediator, not because we want to dominate, not because we somehow know best, but because we have something that no other actor in the international system has. We have the trust and the confidence of both sides, including the Israelis. And that is absolutely critical. So yes, it's too complicated to do solo peacemaking. That era is over. We can't pay for it. We don't have the expertise to support it. We're going to need the Arabs big time investing in it. We're going to need the Europeans as well. That actually, I think you'll see a new focus on group behavior in the next administration.
Thank you very much for your talk. I know we don't usually do this here, but I wanted to stand up and cheer when you finished your comments. I have two things I wanted to ask if you would comment on. One, when George W. Bush was elected president, I had hoped that he would bring in people like James Baker. Why has he avoided James Baker? And the second one is you've been involved with the Seeds of Peace. Would you comment on that and how your hopes that Seeds of Peace will make some changes?
If I had my way, I would remove the word peace from the active lexicon and vocabulary of Arab-Israeli diplomacy. I know I can't. And I know it's wrong to, because you cannot deny people's hopes and aspirations, but there's a cruel reality which we have to get used to. We've never had Arab-Israeli peace, we don't have it now, and we're probably not going to have it for quite some time to come. Because diplomats and governments cannot legislate changes in human behavior. That's what I call transactional diplomacy. That's what we do. We do transactional diplomacy. It's great. It's important because you end conflict using transactional diplomacy. You negotiate political agreements using transactional diplomacy. But that doesn't transform the way people look at each other. For that, you need what I call transformational diplomacy. Governments don't do that very well for all kinds of reasons. Non-governmental organizations do it. Seeds of Peace is an example of an organization that tried, and still does, to bring young people from regions of conflict to a secure environment in Maine, and during a 3.5-week period to try to do transformative diplomacy. And I'm telling you, if you didn't witness it with your own eyes, you would never believe that it was possible. You take young people who live kilometers away from one another in Jerusalem, who are taught to hate and despise one another, you put them on an airplane, you fly them into New York or Logan, you put them on a bus, you take them to Maine. The first night they're exhausted, they may have introduced themselves to one another, and then you talk to them in the morning and you ask them how they slept, and you know what they say? We didn't sleep well, many of them. Why? Are you homesick? Are you ill? No. Why didn't you fall asleep? We were terrified. What were you afraid of? That we would be killed during the middle of the night. Within 3.5 weeks of that initial night, and I'm telling you, I used to recharge my batteries at the State Department in the 90s to go up to Maine to spend a couple days to see what was actually possible. Within 3.5 weeks, these young people are, as they put them on buses to begin their journey from the future back into the past, they are in mourning, weeping. Because when you hear the story of the so-called other, not from a parent, or an imam, or a rabbi, or a priest, or certainly not from a politician, but you hear it from a peer whose empathy and decency and humanity you cannot deny, you begin to change. And at 15, 16, and 17, you are ripe for change. The problem is, you send them back. SEEDS runs programs in these regions. It's very, very hard to maintain this sense of identity and cohesion. And that's 300 kids a summer. What if you brought 3,000 kids? It's such an elemental notion. And it's critically important to accompany the transactional diplomacy that the governments do. Jim Baker was the best negotiator I've ever worked with. He was not sentimental. He wasn't terribly interested in the Arab-Israeli issue. He knew what he had to know. And he was a force. People took him seriously when he walked in the room. You read, I have a chapter on Baker. It's a really funny, sensitive chapter. And I've interviewed all these guys. They're all the three chapters on Kissinger, Carter, and Baker start with interviews with them. Baker was quite remarkable. He was a wasted asset between the years 89 and 92. Had we had Baker and the circumstances that Bill Clinton inherited, you would have had one agreement. I said this earlier, we would have been having a different conversation tonight than the one we're having. So I have tremendous admiration for I don't know why the president, current president, hasn't found a role for him. Clearly, the former Secretary of State did a rather remarkable job in Florida. It's interesting because I worked and was close to both Warren Christopher and Jim Baker. Both were sent by their respective political candidates to Florida in 2000. One of them emerged victorious. But I don't know what the source of the tension is there. But he's a remarkably talented and gifted negotiator. He really is.
Thank you very much for coming tonight. I was wondering, with Iran in the news both for its nuclear development and its aggressive diplomatic stance towards Israel, if you saw a future Iran-Israel conflict as a threat to Arab-Israeli peace?
Look, I think that tiny states who live in dangerous neighborhoods, I'm not trying to moralize here, are going to be extremely careful and deliberate with respect to worst-casing the threats that they confront. We have a challenge, and I referred to the ticking clock. Iran is not weaponized, and there are different assessments over when they'll have enough enriched high-grade uranium to actually proceed to build a weapon. Some people say 09, some say 2010, who knows? There's a brief and scary period that you will begin to enter next year. And if you talk to the Israelis, and maybe they're trying to frighten and motivate people to act to try to deal with this issue. But it's a real danger. I think it is one that it's like the ghost of Christmas future. It does not have to be. There is another way, and we need to find out what that other way is so that the Israelis are not in a position to come to us one morning and say, we have no choice. And they will come to us, and we will say, you can't do this, give us more time, don't do this, we'll figure a way out of it. But I just, it's an existential problem. I do not believe Iran is a crazy state. I think it's driven by its own national interest, its factionalism, its profound sense of entitlement on one hand, that it is a great power and a great nation, and a profound sense of insecurity on the other. This is a very dangerous combination. Insecurity and entitlement, a very dangerous combination. And not coincidentally, it explains some of the powers that have acquired nuclear weapons, some of the smaller powers that have acquired nuclear weapons, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the North Koreans, and the Israelis. Insecurity and entitlement. This is something that can be headed off. I really do believe that, and I'm confident that we have a good chance to do so.
Thank you for your talk. My questions and my concerns are more related to priorities. It seems like in the past 8 years, we've sunk $1 trillion into a state-building project in Iraq that has not been very successful. We've antagonized Iran, and our policies in the Palestinian territories have exacerbated that conflict. So it seems like the United States seems that we face an unprecedented number of boilerplates in the region at this moment. We have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we have Iraq, we have Iran, and if we look a little bit further east, we have Pakistan, a state whose politics we don't really understand that well, given now sort of limited financial resources and very limited political capital in the region. What do you see as priorities for the next administration among these four, and are they separate tracks? Can they be related somehow in negotiations?
Well, not all of them can come to fruition at the same time. I laid out three or four priorities for the next president. One is generated not by law, but by a campaign commitment. And that one is already underway and is being planned, and I suspect will be as competently managed as we possibly can manage it. What I'm less sure about is what it is we will leave behind. But that then is related to the second issue of engaging with the Iranians, because how we comport ourselves with Iran may well go a long way in shaping how much trouble Iraq may find itself in the wake of an American departure. Remember, we're not talking about extricating all American forces, but certainly the bulk of them. Arab-Israeli needs to be managed, but there will come a point where the president and the secretary of state will have to reach a decision. Either the gaps are readily apparent and there's a way to bridge them, or they're not. But see, all of these things, and I don't want to ask too much of the next president, all of these things can be managed in a way, in large part because the level of expectations as a consequence of the last 16 years, particularly the last 8, are very, very low. Very low. You can't get away by changing the music and creating a process if it turns out that it's empty, or the music ends up to be out of tune or discordant. But I suspect these three pieces, Iraq, Iran, and the Arab-Israeli, may complement one another in what could be an effective strategy. And if you've got a president and a secretary of state and a team integrated with the other agencies of government, I could actually see something coming together that would hold out the prospect of success. No quick or early breakthroughs. It's a long movie. It's just we've got to make sure that we've turned, you know, the first piece of advice they give when you're in a hole, the first piece of advice is to stop digging. And that makes a lot of sense to me. We can stop digging in these three issues and turn around. We're very smart when we're, I'll say it again, three words. That would be my mantra: tough, smart, and fair. If we are tough, smart, and fair, we can figure a way to cope with this investment trap so that next year, when I come back to the Miller Center, we'll be in a much improved situation. That's pretty optimistic.
Aaron, thank you very, very much. As a Palestinian and the grandfather of a young Jewish man, I'm very optimistic about the possibilities of having peace in our lifetime. I was involved in a dialogue group where we decided that in the early 80s, where we decided that a two-state solution was the answer. But then the Jewish members of the group were hated by the Jewish community, as well as the Palestinian members of the group were hated by the Palestinian members of the community because of their stand. As long as more and more Jews enter the West Bank and live in the West Bank, it's going to make it more and more difficult to have a two-state solution. Your comment, please, on a one-state solution.
A one-state solution is not a solution, it's an outcome. It's not a solution. A solution is something that parties commit themselves to and they work toward it. One state is a historical outcome, and I, you know, every time I hear the one-state solution, I wonder what it's really based on. In large part, it's based on despair, both on the part of Israelis and particularly Palestinians. It emerges as a weapon that is used to beat, in this case, the Israelis over the head, because they lack the demographic advantage, and time, which I argue is the ultimate arbiter of everything, might appear to be on the side of those who would simply wait for the demographic advantage to make itself manifest. And over time, Israeli institutions and the notion of a Jewish state would collapse. I don't see any of that. Certainly in my lifetime, I don't see any of that happening. A two-state solution now is time sensitive. It really is time sensitive. There was a time a decade ago I would have said we have we have an unlimited amount of time. We don't. The facts on the ground are determinative, but so are the facts up here. It's the software, frankly, rather than the hardware on the ground that concerns me. Because with enough will and creativity and leadership, I'll use that word again, leadership, I could envision a two-state solution. And I just believe that the difficulties and obstacles in front of it, which are out of range of an incoming American president, what to do about Palestinian national reconciliation is a extremely complex problem, and yet it's critical to the process and successful negotiation of an agreement. So I would like to say to you that I think it's manageable, and with enough commitment on the part of the next president, it can be done within the next 3 to 5 years. As tempted as I am, and I don't have the right to abandon the future or mortgage it. I have a 28-year-old and a 25-year-old, but what right do I say to you that there is no two-state solution? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it is time sensitive. I will no longer harbor my own illusions, because those illusions have gotten us into trouble. As I said to you, if I'm a new president faced with a choice, I'll manage the Israeli-Palestinian problem to the best of my ability, but if I want a success, I'll try for an Israeli-Syrian agreement.
Aaron David Miller, thank you very much for your talk and for your contributions to our country.